it to, really. Any girl would. Why? He said egotistically. Because your face is so cruel and your eyes are so kind. Is that why you let me kiss you in the bookshop? I didn't let you. I had no choice. You could have yelled for help afterward. By then all I wanted was for you to do it again. I must have guessed what you were really like. It was her turn to be egotistical. What am I really like? Cold as ice on the surface, hot as hell below. She giggled. I'm such an actor. Everyone in St. Petersburg thinks I'm so good. I'm held up as an example to younger girls, just like Anna Karenina. Now that I know how bad I really am, I have to pretend to be twice as virginal as before. You can't be twice as virginal as anything. I wonder if they're all pretending, she resumed. Take my father. If he knew I was here like this, he'd die of rage. But he must have had the same feelings when he was young, don't you think? I think it's an imponderable, Felix said. But what would he do, really, if he found out? Horsewhip you. He'd have to catch me first. Felix was struck by a thought. How old are you?
Almost 18.
My God, I could go to jail for seducing you. I'd make Father get you out. He rolled over on his front and looked at her. What are we going to do, Lydia?
When?
In the long term. We're going to be lovers until I come of age, and then we'll get married. He stared at her. Do you mean that?
Of course.
She seemed genuinely surprised that he had not made the same assumption.
What else could we do?
You want to marry me?
Yes. Isn't that what you want?
Oh, yes, he breathed. That's what I want. She sat up with her legs spread either side of his face and stroked his hair.
Then that's what we'll do,
Felix said. You never tell me how you managed to get away to come here.
It's not very interesting, she said. I tell lies, I bribe servants, and I take risks. Tonight, for example, the reception at the embassy starts at 6:30. I left home at 6 o'clock, and I'll get there at 7:15. The carriage is in the park. The coachman thinks I'm taking a walk with my maid. The maid is outside this house, dreaming about how she will spend the 10 rubles I will give her for keeping her mouth shut.
It's 7:50, Felix said.
Oh, God, quick! Do it to me with your tongue before I have to go.
That night Felix was asleep, dreaming about Lydia's father, whom he had never seen, when they burst into his room carrying lamps. He woke instantly and jumped out of bed. At first he thought students from the university were playing a prank on him. Then one of them punched his face and kicked him in the stomach, and he knew they were the secret police. He assumed they were arresting him on account of Lydia, and he was terrified for her. Would she be publicly disgraced? Was her father crazy enough to make her give evidence in court against her lover? He watched the police put all his books and a bundle of letters in a sack. The books were all borrowed, but none of the owners was foolish enough to put his name inside. The letters were from his father and his sister, Natasha. He had never had any letters from Lydia, and now he was thankful for that. He was marched out of the building and thrown into a four-wheeled cab. They drove across the chain bridge and then followed the canals as if avoiding the main streets. Felix asked, "Am I going to the Lidovsky prison?" Nobody replied, but when they went over the palace bridge he realized he was being taken to the notorious fortress of St. Peter and St. Paul, and his heart sank. On the other side of the bridge the carriage turned left and entered a darkened, arched passage. It stopped at a gate. Felix was taken into a reception hall, where an army officer looked at him and wrote something in a book. He was put in the cab again and driven deeper into the fortress. They stopped at another gate and waited several minutes until it was opened from the inside by a soldier. From there, Felix had to walk through a series of narrow passages to a third iron gate, which led to a large, damp room. The prison governor sat at a table. He said, "You are charged with being an anarchist. Do you admit it?" Felix was elated, so this was nothing to do with Lydia.
"Admit it," he said. "I boast of it."
One of the policemen produced a book which was signed by the governor. Felix was stripped naked, then given a green flannel dressing gown, a pair of thick woolen stockings, and 2 yellow felt slippers, much too big. From there an armed soldier took him through more gloomy corridors to a cell.
A heavy oak door closed behind him, and he heard a key turn in the lock. The cell contained a bed, a table, a stool, and a washstand. The window was an embrasure in an enormously thick wall. The floor was covered with painted felt, and the walls were cushioned with some kind of yellow upholstery. Felix sat on the bed. This was where Peter the First had tortured and killed his own son. This was where Princess Tarakanova had been kept in a cell which flooded so that the rats climbed all over her to save themselves from drowning. This was where Catherine the Second buried her enemies alive. Dostoevsky had been imprisoned here, Felix thought proudly. So had Bakunin, who had been chained to a wall for 2 years. Nechayev had died here. Felix was at once elated to be in such heroic company and terrified at the thought that he might be here forever. The key turned in the lock. A little bald man with spectacles came in carrying a pen, a bottle of ink, and some paper. He set them down on the table and said, "Write the names of all the subversives you know." Felix sat down and wrote, "Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, Peter Kropotkin, Jesus Christ." The bald man snatched away the paper. He went to the door of the cell and knocked. Two hefty guards came in. They strapped Felix to the table and took off his slippers and stockings. They began to lash the soles of his feet with whips. The torture went on all night. When they pulled out his fingernails, he began to give them made-up names and addresses, but they told him they knew they were false. When they burned the skin of his testicles with a candle flame, he named all his student friends, but still they said he was lying. Each time he passed out, they revived him. Sometimes they would stop for a while and allow him to think it was all over at last. Then they would begin again, and he would beg them to kill him so that the pain would stop. They carried on long after he had told them everything he knew. It must have been around dawn that he passed out for the last time. When he came round, he was lying on the bed. There were bandages on his feet and hands. He was in agony. He wanted to kill himself, but he was too weak to move. The bald man came into the cell in the evening. When he saw him, Felix began to sob with terror. The man just smiled and went away. He never came back. A doctor came to see Felix each day. Felix tried without success to pump him for information. Did anyone outside know that Felix was here? Had there been any messages? Had anyone tried to visit? The doctor just changed the dressings and went away. Felix speculated. Lydia would have gone to his room and found the place in disarray. Someone in the house would have told her that the secret police had taken him away. What would she have done then? Would she make frantic inquiries, careless of her reputation? Would she have been discreet and gone quietly to see the Minister of Interior with some story about the boyfriend of her maid having been jailed in error? Every day he hoped for word from her, but it never came. Eight weeks later, he could walk almost normally, and they released him without explanation. He went to his lodging. He expected to find a message from her there, but there was nothing, and his room had been let to someone else. He wondered why Lydia had not continued to pay the rent. He went to her house and knocked at the front door. A servant answered. Felix said, "Felix Davidovich Chesinsky presents his compliments to Lydia Shatova." The servant slammed the door. Finally, he went to the bookshop. The old bookseller said, "Hello, I've got a message for you. It was brought yesterday by her maid." Felix tore open the envelope with trembling fingers. It was written not by Lydia, but by the maid. It read, "I have been let go and have no job. It is all your fault. She is wed and gone to England yesterday. Now you know the wages of sin." He looked up at the bookseller with tears of anguish in his eyes. "Is that all?" he cried. He learned no more for 19 years. Normal regulations had been temporarily suspended in the Walden house, and Charlotte sat in the kitchen with the servants. The kitchen was spotless, for of course the family had dined out. The fire had gone out in the great range, and the high windows were wide open, letting in the cool night air. The crockery used for servants' meals was racked neatly in the dresser. The cook's knives and spoons hung from a row of hooks. Her innumerable bowls and pans were out of sight in the massive oak cupboards. Charlotte had had no time to be frightened. At first, when the coach stopped so abruptly in the park, she had been merely puzzled, and after that her concern had been to stop Mama screaming. When they got home, she had found herself a little shaky, but now, looking back, she found the whole thing rather exciting. The servants felt the same way. It was very reassuring to sit around the massive bleached wooden table and talk things over with these people who were so much a part of her life. The cook, who had always been motherly, Pritchard, whom Charlotte respected because Papa respected him, the efficient and capable Mrs. Mitchell, who as housekeeper always had a solution to any problem. William, the coachman, was the hero of the hour. He described several times the wild look in his assailant's eyes as the man menaced him with the gun. Basking in the awestruck gaze of the under-house parlourmaid, he recovered rapidly from the indignity of having walked into the kitchen stark naked. "Of course," Pritchard explained. "I naturally presumed the thief just wanted William's clothes. I knew Charles was at the palace so he could drive the coach. I thought I wouldn't inform the police until after speaking to his lordship." Charles, the footman, said, "Imagine how I felt when I found the carriage gone," I said to myself. "I'm sure it was left here." "Oh, well, I thinks. William's moved it. I run up and down the mall. I look everywhere. In the end, I go back to the palace. 'Here's trouble,' I says to the doorman. 'The Earl of Walden's carriage is gone missing.' He says to me, 'Walden?' he says, not very respectful." Mrs. Mitchell interrupted. "Palace servants, they think they're better than the nobility. He says to me, 'Walden's gone, mate.' I thought, 'God blimey, I'm for it.' I come running through the park, and halfway home I find the carriage, and my lady having hysterics, and my lord with blood on his sword." Mrs. Mitchell said, "And after all that, nothing stolen." "A lunatic," said Charles. "An ingenious lunatic." There was general agreement. The cook poured the tea and served Charlotte first. "How is my lady now?" she said. "Oh, she's all right," Charlotte said. "She went to bed and took a dose of laudanum. She must be asleep by now." "And the gentlemen?" "Papa and Prince Olaf are in the drawing-room having a brandy." The cook sighed heavily. "Robbers in the park and suffragettes at the court. I don't know what we're coming to." "There'll be a socialist revolution," said Charles. "You mark my words." "We'll all be murdered in our beds," the cook said lugubriously. Charlotte said, "What did the suffragette mean about the king torturing women?" As she spoke, she looked at Pritchard, who was sometimes willing to explain to her things she was not supposed to know about. "She was talking about force-feeding," Pritchard said. "Apparently it's painful." "Force-feeding? When they won't eat, they're fed by force." Charlotte was mystified. "How on earth is that done?" "Several ways," said Pritchard, with a look that indicated he would not go into detail about all of them. "A tube through the nostrils is one." The under-house parlourmaid said, "I wonder what they feed them." Charles said, "Probably hot soup." "I can't believe this," Charlotte said. "Why should they refuse to eat?" "It's a protest," said Pritchard. "Makes difficulties for the prison authorities." "Prison?" Charlotte was astonished. "Why are they in prison?" "For breaking windows, making bombs, disturbing the peace." "But what do they want?" There was a silence as the servants realized that Charlotte had no idea what a suffragette was. Finally, Pritchard said, "They want votes for women." "Oh," Charlotte thought. Did I know that women couldn't vote? She was not sure. She had never thought about that sort of thing. "I think this discussion has gone quite far enough," said Mrs. Mitchell firmly. "You'll be in trouble, Mr. Pritchard, for putting wrong ideas into my lady's head." Charlotte knew that Pritchard never got into trouble because he was practically Papa's friend. She said, "I wonder why they care so much about something like voting." There was a ring, and they all looked instinctively at the bellboard. "Front door," said Pritchard, "at this time of night." He went out, pulling on his coat. Charlotte drank her tea. She felt tired. The suffragettes were puzzling and rather frightening, she decided. But all the same, she wanted to know more. Pritchard came back. "Plate of sandwiches, please, cook," he said. "Charles, take a fresh soda siphon to the drawing-room." He began to arrange plates and napkins on a tray. "Well, come on," Charlotte said. "Who is it?" "A gentleman from Scotland Yard," said Pritchard. Basil Thompson was a bullet-headed man, with light-coloured receding hair, a heavy moustache, and a penetrating gaze. Walden had heard of him. His father had been Archbishop of York. Thompson had been educated at Eton and Oxford, and had done service in the colonies as a native commissioner and as Prime Minister of Tonga. He had come home to qualify as a barrister, and then had worked in the prison service, ending up as governor of Dartmoor Prison with a reputation as a riot-breaker. From prisons, he had gravitated toward police work and had become an expert on the mixed criminal-anarchist milieu of London's East End. This expertise had got him the top job in the special branch, the political police force. Walden sat him down and began to recount the evening's events. As he spoke, he kept an eye on Alex. The boy was superficially calm, but his face was pale. He sipped steadily at a glass of brandy and soda, and his left hand clutched rhythmically at the arm of his chair. At one point, Thompson interrupted Walden, saying, "Did you notice, when the carriage picked you up, that the footman was missing?" "Yes, I did," Walden said. "I asked the coachman where he was, but the coachman seemed not to hear. Then, because there was such a crush at the palace door and my daughter was telling me to hurry up, I decided not to press the matter until we got home." "Our villain was relying on that, of course. You must have a cool nerve. Go on." "The carriage stopped suddenly in the park and the door was thrown open by the man." "What did he look like?" "Tall. He had a scarf or something over his face. Dark hair, staring eyes." "All criminals have staring eyes," Thompson said. "Earlier on, had the coachman got a better look at him?" "Not much. At that time the man wore a hat, and of course it was dark." And then?" Walden took a deep breath. At the time he had been not so much frightened as angry, but now, when he looked back on it, he was full of fear for what might have happened to Alex or Lydia or Charlotte. He said, "Lady Walden screamed, and that seemed to disconcert the fellow. Perhaps he had not expected to find any women in the coach. Anyway, he hesitated. And thank God he did," he thought. "I poked him with my sword, and he dropped the gun." "Did you do him much damage?" "I doubt it. I couldn't get a swing in that confined space, and of course the sword isn't particularly sharp. I blooded him, though. I wish I had chopped off his damned head." The butler came in, and conversation stopped. Walden realized he had been talking rather loudly. He tried to calm himself. Pritchard served sandwiches and brandy and soda to the three men. Walden said, "You'd better stay up, Pritchard, but you can send everyone else to bed." "Very good, my lord." When he had gone, Walden said, "It is possible that this was just a robbery. I've let the servants think that, and Lady Walden and Charlotte too. However, a robber would hardly have needed such an elaborate plan, to my mind. I am perfectly certain that it was an attempt on Alex's life." Thompson looked at Alex. "I'm afraid I agree. Have you any idea how he knew where to find you?" Alex crossed his legs. "My movements haven't been secret." "That must change. Tell me, sir, has your life ever been threatened?" "I live with threats," Alex said tightly. "There has never been an attempt before." "Is there any reason why you in particular should be the target of nihilists or revolutionists?" "For them, it is enough that I am a prince." Walden realized that the problems of the English establishment with suffragettes and liberals and trade unions were trivial by comparison with what the Russians had to cope with, and he felt a surge of sympathy for Alex. Alex went on in a quiet, controlled voice. "However, I am known to be something of a reformer by Russian standards. They could pick a more appropriate victim." "Even in London," Thompson agreed, "there's always a Russian aristocrat or two in London for the season." Walden said, "What are you getting at?" Thompson said, "I'm wondering whether the villain knew what Prince Orlov is doing here, and whether his motive for tonight's attack was to sabotage your talks." Walden was dubious. "How would the revolutionists have found that out?" "I'm just speculating," Thompson replied. "Would this be an effective way to sabotage your talks?" "Very effective indeed," Walden said. The thought made him go cold. If the Tsar were to be told that his nephew had been assassinated in London by a revolutionist, especially if it were an expatriate Russian revolutionist, he would go through the roof. "You know, Thompson, how the Russians feel about our having their subversives here. Our open-door policy has caused friction at the diplomatic level for years. Something like this could destroy Anglo-Russian relations for 20 years. There would be no question of an alliance then." Thompson nodded. "I was afraid of that. Well, there's no more we can do tonight. I'll set my department to work at dawn. We'll search the park for clues and interview your servants, and I expect we'll round up a few anarchists in the East End." Alex said, "Do you think you will catch the man?" Walden longed for Thompson to give a reassuring answer, but it was not forthcoming. "It won't be easy," Thompson said. "He's obviously a planner, so he'll have a bolt hole somewhere. We've no proper description of him. Unless his wounds take him to hospital, our chances are slim."
"He may try to kill me again," Alex said.
"So we must take evasive action. I propose you should move out of this house tomorrow. We'll take the top floor of one of the hotels for you in a false name and give you a bodyguard. Lord Walden will have to meet with you secretly, and you will have to cut out social engagements, of course."
"Of course." Thompson stood up.
"It's very late. I'll set all this in motion." Walden rang for Pritchard.
"You've got a carriage waiting, Thompson?"
"Yes. Let us speak on the telephone tomorrow morning."
Pritchard saw Thompson out, and Alex went off to bed. Walden told Pritchard to lock up, then went upstairs. He was not sleepy. As he undressed, he let himself relax and feel all the conflicting emotions that he had so far held at bay. He felt proud of himself at first. After all, he thought, "I drew a sword and fought off an assailant. Not bad for a man of 50 with a gouty leg." Then he became depressed when he recalled how coolly they had all discussed the diplomatic consequences of the death of Alex. Bright, cheerful, shy, handsome, clever Alex, whom Walden had seen grow into a man. He got into bed and lay awake, reliving the moment when the carriage door flew open and the man stood there with the gun. And now he was frightened, not for himself or Alex, but for Lydia and Charlotte. The thought that they might have been killed made him tremble in his bed. He remembered holding Charlotte in his arms 18 years ago, when she had blonde hair and no teeth. He remembered her learning to walk and forever falling on her bottom. He remembered giving her a pony of her own, and thinking that her joy when she gave it to him the biggest thrill of his life. He remembered her just a few hours ago, walking into the royal presence with her head held high, a grown woman, and a beautiful one. If she died, he thought, I don't know that I could bear it. And Lydia, if Lydia were dead, I would be alone. The thought made him get up and go through to her room. There was a nightlight beside her bed. She was in a deep sleep, lying on her back, her mouth a little open, her hair a blonde skein across the pillow. She looked soft and vulnerable. I have never been able to make you understand how much I love you, he thought. Suddenly he needed to touch her, to feel that she was warm and alive. He got into bed with her and kissed her. Her lips responded, but she did not wake up. Lydia, he thought, I could not live without you. Lydia had lain awake for a long time, thinking about the man with the gun. It had been a brutal shock, and she had screamed in sheer terror. But there was more to it than that. There had been something about the man, something about his stance or his shape or his clothes, that had seemed dreadfully sinister in an almost supernatural way, as if he were a ghost. She wished she could have seen his eyes. After a while she had taken another dose of laudanum, and then she slept. She dreamed that the man with the gun came to her room and got into bed with her. It was her own bed, but in the dream she was 18 years old again. The man put his gun down on the white pillow beside her head. He still had the scarf around his face. She realized that she loved him. She kissed his lips through the scarf. He made love to her beautifully. She began to think that she might be dreaming. She wanted to see his face. She said, Who are you? And a voice said, Stephen. She knew this was not so, but the gun on the pillow had somehow turned into Stephen's sword, with blood on its point, and she began to have doubts. She clung to the man on top of her, afraid that the dream would end before she was satisfied. Then dimly she began to suspect that she was doing in reality what she was doing in the dream. Yet the dream persisted. Strong physical pleasure possessed her. She began to lose control. Just as her climax began, the man in the dream took the scarf from his face, and in that moment Lydia opened her eyes and saw Stephen's face above her, and then she was overcome by ecstasy. And for the first time in 19 years, she cried for joy. Chapter 5. Charlotte looked forward with mixed feelings to Belinda's coming-out ball.
She had never been to a town ball, although she had been to lots of country balls, many of them at Walden Hall. She liked to dance, and she knew she did it well, but she hated the cattle market business of sitting out with the wallflowers and waiting for a boy to pick you out and ask you to dance. She wondered whether this might be handled in a more civilized way among the smart set. They got to Uncle George and Aunt Clarissa's Mayfair house 30 minutes before midnight, which Mama said was the earliest time one could decently arrive at a London ball. A striped canopy and a red carpet led from the curb to the garden gate, which had somehow been transformed into a Roman triumphal arch. But even that did not prepare Charlotte for what she saw when she passed through the arch. The whole side garden had been turned into a Roman atrium. She gazed about her in wonderment. The lawns and the flower beds had been covered over with a hardwood dance floor, stained in black and white squares to look like marble tiles. A colonnade of white pillars, linked with chains of laurel, bordered the floor. Beyond the pillars, in a kind of cloister, there were raised benches for the sitters out. In the middle of the floor, a fountain in the form of a boy with a dolphin splashed in a marble basin, the streams of water lit by coloured spotlights. On the balcony of an upstairs bedroom, a band played ragtime. Garlands of smilax and roses decorated the walls, and baskets of begonias hung from the balcony. A huge canvas roof, painted sky blue, covered the whole area from the eaves of the house to the garden wall.
"It's a miracle," Charlotte said.
Papa said to his brother,
"Quite a crowd, George."
"We invited 800. What the devil happened to you in Park?"
"Oh, it wasn't as bad as it sounded," Papa said with a forced smile. He took George by the arm and they moved to one side to talk. Charlotte studied the guests. All the men wore full evening dress, white tie, white waistcoat and tails. It particularly suited the young men, or at least the slim men, Charlotte thought. It made them look quite dashing as they danced. Observing the dresses, she decided that hers and her mother's, though rather tasteful, were a trifle old-fashioned, with their wasp waists and ruffles and sweepers. Aunt Clarissa wore a long, straight, slender gown with a skirt almost too tight to dance in, and Belinda had harem pants. Charlotte realized she knew nobody. "Who will dance with me?" she wondered, "after Papa and Uncle George." However, Aunt Clarissa's younger brother, Jonathan, waltzed with her, then introduced her to three men who were at Oxford with him, each of whom danced with her. She found their conversation monotonous. They said the floor was good, and the band, Gottlieb's, was good. Then they ran out of steam. Charlotte tried, "Do you believe that women should have the vote?" The replies she got were, "Certainly not. No opinion. And you're not one of them, are you?" The last of her partners, whose name was Freddy, took her into the house for supper. He was a rather sleek young man, with regular features, handsome, I suppose, Charlotte thought, and fair hair. He was at the end of his first year at Oxford. Oxford was rather jolly, he said, but he confessed he was not much of a one for reading books, and he rather thought he would not go back in October. The inside of the house was festooned with flowers and bright with electric light. For supper there was hot and cold soup, lobster, quail, strawberries, ice cream, and hothouse peaches.
"Always the same old food for supper," Freddy said. "They all use the same caterer."
"Do you go to a lot of balls?" Charlotte asked.
"'Fraid so. All the time, really, in the season."
Charlotte drank a glass of champagne cup in the hope that it would make her feel more gay. Then she left Freddy and wandered through a series of reception rooms. In one of them, several games of bridge were underway. Two elderly duchesses held court in another. In a third, older men played billiards while younger men smoked. Charlotte found Belinda there with a cigarette in her hand. Charlotte had never seen the point of tobacco unless one wanted to look sophisticated. Belinda certainly looked sophisticated.
"I adore your dress," Belinda said.
"No, you don't. But you look sensational. How did you persuade your stepmother to let you dress like that?"
"She'd like to wear one herself."
"She seems so much younger than my mama, which she is, of course. And being a stepmother makes a difference. Whatever happened to you after the court?"
"Oh, it was extraordinary. A madman pointed a gun at us."
"Your mama was telling me. Weren't you simply terrified?"
"I was too busy calming mama. Afterwards I was scared to death.
Why did you say at the palace that you wanted to have a long talk with me?"
"Ah, listen." She took Charlotte aside away from the young men. "I've discovered how they come out."
"What?"
"Babies."
"Oh." Charlotte was all ears. Do tell. Belinda lowered her voice. They come out between your legs, where you make water. It's too small. It stretches. How awful, Charlotte thought. But that's not all, Belinda said. I found out how they start. How?
Belinda took Charlotte's elbow and they walked to the far side of the room. They stood in front of a mirror garlanded with roses. Belinda's voice fell almost to a whisper.
When you get married, you know you have to go to bed with your husband?
Do you?
Yes.
Papa and Mama have separate bedrooms.
Don't they adjoin?
Yes.
That's so that they can get into the same bed.
Why?
Because to start a baby, the husband has to put his pego into that place where the babies come out.
What's a pego?
Hush! It's a thing men have between their legs. Haven't you ever seen a picture of Michelangelo's David?
No.
Well, it's a thing they make water with. Looks like a finger.
And you have to do that to start babies?
Yes. And all married people have to do it?
Yes.
How dreadful. Who told you all this?
Viola Pontedavi. She swore it was true.
And somehow Charlotte knew it was true. Hearing it was like being reminded of something she had forgotten. It seemed unaccountably to make sense. Yet she felt physically shocked. It was the slightly queasy feeling she sometimes got in dreams when a terrible suspicion turned out to be correct, or when she was afraid of falling and suddenly found she was falling.
I'm jolly glad you found out, she said. If one got married without knowing, how embarrassing it would be.
Your mother is supposed to explain it all to you the night before your wedding, but if your mother is too shy, you just find out when it happens.
Thank heaven for Viola Pontedavi, Charlotte was struck by a thought.
Has all this got something to do with bleeding, you know, every month?
I don't know.
I expect it has. It's all connected. All the things people don't talk about.
Well, now we know why they don't talk about it. It's so disgusting.
The thing you have to do in bed is called sexual intercourse, but Viola says the common people call it swiving.
She knows a lot. She's got brothers. They told her years ago.
How did they find out?
From older boys at school. Boys are ever so interested in that sort of thing.
Well, Charlotte said, it does have a sort of horrid fascination.
Suddenly she saw in the mirror the reflection of Aunt Clarissa.
What are you two doing huddled in a corner? She said.
Charlotte flushed, but apparently Aunt Clarissa did not want an answer, for she went on,
Do please move around and talk to people, Belinda. It is your party.
She went away, and the two girls moved on through the reception rooms. The rooms were arranged on a circular plan so that you could walk through them all and end up where you had started at the top of the staircase. Charlotte said, I don't think I could ever bring myself to do it.
Couldn't you?
Belinda said with a funny look.
What do you mean?
I don't know. I've been thinking about it. It might be quite nice.
Charlotte stared at her.
Belinda looked embarrassed.
I must go and dance, she said. See you later on.
She went down the stairs. Charlotte watched her go and wondered how many more shocking secrets life had to reveal. She went back into the supper room and got another glass of champagne cup. What a peculiar way for the human race to perpetuate itself, she thought. She supposed animals did something similar. What about birds? No, birds had eggs. And such words, pego and swiving. All these hundreds of elegant and refined people around her knew those words but never mentioned them. Because they were never mentioned, they were embarrassing. Because they were embarrassing, they were never mentioned. There was something very silly about the whole thing. If the Creator had ordained that people should swive, why pretend that they did not? She finished her drink and went outside to the dance floor. Papa and Mama were dancing a polka and doing it rather well. Mama had got over the incident in the park, but it still preyed on Papa's mind. He looked very fine in white tie and tails. When his leg was bad, he would not dance, but obviously it was giving him no trouble tonight. He was surprisingly light on his feet for a big man. Mama seemed to be having a wonderful time. She was able to let herself go a bit when she danced. Her usual studied reserve fell away, and she smiled radiantly and let her ankles show. When the polka was over, Papa caught Charlotte's eye and came over.
May I have this dance, Lady Charlotte?
Certainly, my lord. It was a waltz.
Papa seemed distracted, but he whirled her around the floor expertly. She wondered whether she looked radiant, like Mama. Probably not. Suddenly she thought of Papa and Mama swiving, and found the idea terribly embarrassing. Papa said, "Are you enjoying your first big ball?" "Yes, thank you," she said, dutifully. "You seem thoughtful." "I'm on my best behavior." The lights and the bright colors blurred slightly, and suddenly she had to concentrate on staying upright. She was afraid she might fall over and look foolish. Papa sensed her unsteadiness and held her a little more firmly. A moment later the dance ended. Papa took her off the floor. He said, "Are you feeling quite well?" "Fine, but I was dizzy for a moment." "Have you been smoking?" Charlotte laughed. "Certainly not." "That's the usual reason young ladies feel dizzy at balls. Take my advice. When you want to try tobacco, do it in private." "I don't think I want to try it." She set out the next dance, and then Freddie turned up again. As she danced with him, it occurred to her that all the young men and girls, including Freddie and herself, were supposed to be looking for husbands or wives during the season, especially at balls like this. For the first time, she considered Freddie as a possible husband for herself. It was unthinkable. "Then what kind of husband do I want?" she wondered. She really had no idea. Freddie said, "Jonathan just said, 'Freddie, meet Charlotte,' but I gather you're called Lady Charlotte Walden." "Yes. Who are you?" "Marquis of Chalfont, actually." So, Charlotte thought, we're socially compatible. A little later, she and Freddie got into conversation with Belinda and Freddie's friends. They talked about a new play called Pygmalion, which was said to be absolutely hilarious but quite vulgar. The boys spoke of going to a boxing match, and Belinda said she wanted to go too, but they all said it was out of the question. They discussed jazz music. One of the boys was something of a connoisseur, having lived for a while in the United States. But Freddie disliked it, and talked rather pompously about the negrification of society. They all drank coffee, and Belinda smoked another cigarette. Charlotte began to enjoy herself. It was Charlotte's mamma who came along and broke up the party. "Your father and I are leaving," she said. "Shall we send the coach back for you?" Charlotte realized she was tired. "No, I'll come," she said. "What time is it?" 4 o'clock. They went to get their wraps. Mama said, "Did you have a lovely evening?" "Yes, thank you, Mama." "So did I. Who were those young men?" "They know Jonathan." "Were they nice?" The conversation got quite interesting in the end. Papa had called the carriage already. As they drove away from the bright lights of the party, Charlotte remembered what had happened last time they rode in a carriage, and she felt scared. Papa held Mama's hand. They seemed happy. Charlotte felt excluded. She looked out of the window. In the dawn light, she could see 4 men in silk hats walking up Park Lane, going home from some nightclub, perhaps. As the carriage rounded Hyde Park Corner, Charlotte saw something odd. "What's that?" she said. Mama looked out. "What's what, dear?" "On the pavement. Looks like people." "That's right." "What are they doing?" "Sleeping." This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. The Man from St. Petersburg by Ken Follett continued. Mama looked out. "What's what, dear?" "On the pavement. Looks like people." "That's right." "What are they doing?" "Sleeping." Charlotte was horrified. There were 8 or 10 of them up against a wall, bundled in coats, blankets, and newspapers. She could not tell whether they were men or women, but some of the bundles were small enough to be children. She said, "Why do they sleep there?" "I don't know, dear," Mama said. Papa said, "Because they've nowhere else to sleep, of course."
"They have no homes?"
"No."
"I didn't know there was anyone that poor," Charlotte said. "How dreadful."
She thought of all the rooms in Uncle George's house, the food that had been laid out to be picked at by 800 people, all of whom had had dinner, and the elaborate gowns they wore new each season while people slept under newspapers. She said, "We should do something for them."
"We?" Papa said. "What should we do?"
"Build houses for them."
"All of them?"
"How many are there?"
Papa shrugged. "Thousands."
"Thousands? I thought it was just those few." Charlotte was devastated. "Couldn't you build small houses?"
"There's no profit in house property, especially at that end of the market."
"Perhaps you should do it anyway."
"Why?"
"Because the strong should take care of the weak. I've heard you say that to Mr. Sampson."
Samson was the bailiff at Walden Hall, and he was always trying to save money on repairs to tenanted cottages.
"We already take care of rather a lot of people," Papa said. "All the servants whose wages we pay, all the tenants who farm our land and live in our cottages, all the workers in the companies we invest in, all the government employees who are paid out of our taxes."
"I don't think that's much of an excuse," Charlotte interrupted. "Those poor people are sleeping on the street. What will they do in winter?"
Mamma said sharply.
"Your papa doesn't need excuses. He was born an aristocrat, and he has managed his estate carefully. He is entitled to his wealth. Those people on the pavement are idlers, criminals, drunkards, and ne'er-do-wells."
"Even the children?"
"Don't be impertinent. Remember, you still have a great deal to learn."
"I'm just beginning to realize how much," Charlotte said.
As the carriage turned into the courtyard of their house, Charlotte glimpsed one of the street sleepers beside the gate. She decided she would take a closer look. The coach stopped beside the front door. Charles handed Mama down, then Charlotte. Charlotte ran across the courtyard. William was closing the gates.
"Just a minute," Charlotte called.
She heard Papa say,
"What the devil?"
She ran out into the street. The sleeper was a woman. She lay slumped on the pavement with her shoulders against the courtyard wall. She wore a man's boots, woolen stockings, a dirty blue coat, and a very large, once fashionable hat with a bunch of grubby artificial flowers in its brim. Her head was slumped sideways, and her face was turned toward Charlotte. There was something familiar about the round face and the wide mouth. The woman was young. Charlotte cried,
"Annie!"
The sleeper opened her eyes. Charlotte stared at her in horror. 2 months ago, Annie had been a housemaid at Walden Hall, in a crisp, clean uniform, with a little white hat on her head, a pretty girl with a large bosom and an irrepressible laugh.
"Annie, what happened to you?"
Annie scrambled to her feet and bobbed a pathetic curtsy.
"Oh, Lady Charlotte, I was hoping I would see you. You was always good to me. I've nowhere to turn."
"But how did you get like this?"
"I was let go, my lady, without a character when they found out I was expecting the baby. I know I done wrong."
"But you're not married."
"But I was courting Jimmy, the undergardener."
Charlotte recalled Belinda's revelations and realized that if all that was true, it would indeed be possible for girls to have babies without being married.
"Where is the baby?"
"I lost it."
"You lost it?"
"I mean, it came too early, m'lady. It was born dead."
"How horrible,"
Charlotte whispered. That was something else she had not known to be possible.
"And why isn't Jimmy with you?"
"He ran away to sea. He did love me, I know, but he was frightened to wed. He was only 17. Annie began to cry. Charlotte heard Papa's voice.
"Charlotte, come in this instant."
She turned to him. He stood at the gate in his evening clothes, with his silk hat in his hand, and suddenly she saw him as a big, smug, cruel old man. She said,
"This is one of the servants you care for so well."
Papa looked at the girl.
"Annie, what is the meaning of this?"
Annie said, "Jimmy ran away, my lord, so I couldn't wed, and I couldn't get another position because you never gave me a character, and I was ashamed to go home, so I come to London."
"You came to London to beg," Papa said harshly.
"Papa!"
Charlotte cried.
"You don't understand, Charlotte."
"I understand perfectly well."
Mama appeared and said, "Charlotte, get away from that creature."
"She's not a creature, she's Annie."
"Annie!" Mama shrilled.
"She's a fallen woman."
"That's enough," Papa said. "This family does not hold discussions in the street. Let us go in immediately."
Charlotte put her arm around Annie.
"She needs a bath, new clothes, and a hot breakfast."
"Don't be ridiculous,"
Mama said. The sight of Annie seemed to have made her almost hysterical.
"All right," Papa said. "Take her into the kitchen. The parlourmaids will be up by now. Tell them to take care of her. Then come and see me in the drawing room."
Mama said,
"Stephen, this is insane."
"Let us go in," said Papa.
They went in. Charlotte took Annie downstairs to the kitchen. A skivvy was cleaning the range, and a kitchen maid was slicing bacon for breakfast. It was just past 5 o'clock. Charlotte had not realized they started work so early. They both looked at her in astonishment when she walked in her ball gown with Annie at her side. Charlotte said,
"This is Annie. She used to work at Walden Hall. She's had some bad luck, but she's a good girl. She must have a bath. Find new clothes for her and burn her old ones. Then give her breakfast."
For a moment, they were both dumbstruck. Then the kitchen maid said,
"Very good, m'lady." "I'll see you later, Annie," Charlotte said. Annie seized Charlotte's arm.
"Oh, thank you, m'lady."
Charlotte went out. Now there will be trouble, she thought, as she went upstairs. She did not care as much as she might have. She almost felt that her parents had betrayed her. What had her years of education been for, when in one night she could find out that the most important things had never been taught her? No doubt they talked of protecting young girls, but Charlotte thought deceit might be the appropriate term. When she thought of how ignorant she had been until tonight, she felt so foolish, and that made her angry. She marched into the drawing-room. Papa stood beside the fireplace, holding a glass. Mama sat at the piano, playing double minor chords with a pained expression on her face. They had drawn back the curtains. The room looked odd in the morning with yesterday's cigar butts and the ashtrays and the cold early light on the edges of things. It was an evening room and wanted lamps and warmth, drinks and footmen, and a crowd of people in formal clothes. Everything looked different today.
"Now then, Charlotte," Papa began, "you don't understand what kind of woman Annie is. We let her go for a reason, you know. She did something very wrong, which I cannot explain to you."
"I know what she did," Charlotte said, sitting down, "and I know who she did it with, a gardener called Jimmy."
Mama gasped. Papa said,
"I don't believe you have any idea what you're talking about."
"And if I haven't, whose fault is it?" Charlotte burst out. "How did I manage to reach the age of 18 without learning that some people are so poor they sleep in the street, that maids who are expecting babies get dismissed, and that men are not made the same as women? Don't stand there telling me I don't understand these things and I have a lot to learn. I spent all my life learning, and now I discover most of it was lies. How dare you? How dare you?"
She burst into tears and hated herself for losing control. She heard Mama say, "Oh, this is too foolish." Papa sat beside her and took her hand.
"I'm sorry you feel that way," he said. "All young girls are kept in ignorance of certain things. It is done for their own good. We have never lied to you. If we did not tell you just how cruel and coarse the world is, that was only because we wanted you to enjoy your childhood for as long as possible. Perhaps we made a mistake."
Mama snapped. "We wanted to keep you out of the trouble that Annie got into."
"I wouldn't put it quite like that," Papa said mildly. Charlotte's rage evaporated. She felt like a child again. She wanted to put her head on Papa's shoulder, but her pride would not let her.
"Shall we all forgive each other and be pals again?" Papa said. An idea which had been quietly budding in Charlotte's mind now blossomed, and she spoke without thinking.
"Would you let me take Annie as my personal maid?"
Papa said. "Well,
we won't even think of it," Mama said hysterically. "It is quite out of the question that an 18-year-old girl who is the daughter of an earl should have a scarlet woman as a maid. No, absolutely and finally no."
"Then what will she do?" Charlotte asked calmly.
"She should have thought of that when... She should have thought of that before,"
Papa said. "Charlotte, we cannot possibly have a woman of bad character to live in this house. Even if I would allow it, the servants would be scandalized. Half of them would give notice. We shall hear mutterings even now just because the girl has been allowed into the kitchen. You see, it is not just Mama and I who shun such people. It is the whole of society."
"Then I shall buy her a house," Charlotte said, "and give her an allowance and be her friend."
"You've no money," Mama said.
"My Russian grandfather left me something,"
Papa said. "But the money is in my care until you reach the age of 21, and I will not allow it to be used for that purpose."
"Then what is to be done with her?" Charlotte said desperately.
"I'll make a bargain with you," Papa said. "I will give her money to get decent lodgings, and I'll see that she gets a job in a factory."
"What will be my part of the bargain?"
"You must promise not to make contact with her ever." Charlotte felt very tired. Papa had all the answers. She could no longer argue with him. And she did not have the power to insist. She sighed.
"All right," she said.
"Good girl. Now then, I suggest you go and find her and tell her the arrangement, then say goodbye."
"I'm not sure I can look her in the eye."
Papa patted her hand. "She will be very grateful, you'll see. When you've spoken to her, you go to bed. I'll see to all the details." Charlotte did not know whether she had won or lost, whether Papa was being cruel or kind, whether Annie should feel saved or spurned. "Very well," she said wearily. She wanted to tell Papa that she loved him, but the words would not come. After a moment, she got up and left the room. On the day after the fiasco, Felix was awakened at noon by Bridget. He felt very weak.
Bridget stood beside his bed with a large cup in her hand. Felix sat up and took the cup. The drink was wonderful. It seemed to consist of hot milk, sugar, melted butter, and lumps of bread. While he drank it, Bridget moved around his room, tidying up, singing a sentimental song about boys who gave their lives for Ireland. She went away and came back again with another Irish woman of her own age, who was a nurse. The woman stitched his hand and put a dressing on the puncture wound in his shoulder. Felix gathered from the conversation that she was the local abortionist. Bridget told her that Felix had been in a fight in a pub. The nurse charged a shilling for the visit and said,
"You won't die. If you'd had yourself seen to straight away, you wouldn't have bled so much. As it is, you'll feel weak for days."
When she had gone, Bridget talked to him. She was a heavy, good-natured woman in her late 50s. Her husband had got into some kind of trouble in Ireland, and they had fled to the anonymity of London, where he died of the booze, she said. She had two sons who were policemen in New York, and a daughter who was in service in Belfast. There was a vein of bitterness in her which showed in an occasional sarcastically humorous remark, usually at the expense of the English. While she was explaining why Ireland should have home rule, Felix went to sleep. She woke him again in the evening to give him hot soup. On the following day, his physical wounds began visibly to heal, and he started to feel the pain of his emotional wounds. All the despair and self-reproach which he had felt in the park as he ran away now came back to him. Running away. How could it happen? Lydia. She was now Lady Walden. He felt nauseated. He made himself think clearly and coolly. He had known that she married and went to England. Obviously, the Englishman she married was likely to be both an aristocrat and a man with a strong interest in Russia. Equally obviously, the person who negotiated with Orlov had to be a member of the establishment and an expert on Russian affairs. I couldn't have guessed it would turn out to be the same man, Felix thought, but I should have realized the possibility. The coincidence was not as remarkable as it had seemed, but it was no less shattering. Twice in his life, Felix had been utterly, blindly, deliriously happy. The first time was when, at the age of 4, before his mother died, he had been given a red ball. The second was when Lydia fell in love with him. But the red ball had never been taken from him. He could not imagine a greater happiness than that which he had had with Lydia, nor a disappointment more appalling than the one that followed. There had certainly been no such highs and lows in Felix's emotional life since then. After she left, he began to tramp the Russian countryside dressed as a monk, preaching the anarchist gospel. He told the peasants that the land was theirs because they tilled it, that the wood in the forest belonged to anyone who felled a tree, that nobody had a right to govern them except themselves, and because self-government was no government, it was called anarchy. He was a wonderful preacher, and he made many friends, but he never fell in love again, and he hoped he never would. His preaching phase had ended in 1899, during the national student strike, when he was arrested as an agitator and sent to Siberia. The years of wandering had already inured him to cold, hunger, and pain, but now, working in a chain gang, using wooden tools to dig out gold in a mine, laboring on when the man chained to his side had fallen dead, seeing boys and women flogged, he came to know darkness, bitterness, despair, and finally hatred. In Siberia, he had learned the facts of life, steal or starve, hide or be beaten, fight or die. There he had acquired cunning and ruthlessness. There he had learned the ultimate truth about oppression, that it works by turning its victims against each other instead of against their oppressors. He escaped and began the long journey into madness, which ended when he killed the policeman outside Omsk and realized that he had no fear. He returned to civilization as a full-blooded revolutionist. It seemed incredible to him that he had once scrupled to throw bombs at the noblemen who maintained those Siberian convict mines. He was enraged by the government-inspired pogroms against the Jews in the west and south of Russia. He was sickened by the wrangling between Bolsheviks and Mensheviks at the Second Congress of the Social Democratic Party. He was inspired by the magazine that came from Geneva called Bread and Liberty, with the quote from Bakunin on its masthead, "The urge to destroy is also a creative urge." Finally, hating the government, disenchanted with the socialists, and convinced by the anarchists, he went to a mill town called
by Ellis Dock and founded a group called Struggle. Those had been the glory years. He would never forget young Nyson Farber, who had knifed the mill owner outside the synagogue on the Day of Atonement. Felix himself had shot the chief of police. Then he took the fight to St. Petersburg, where he founded another anarchist group, the Unauthorized, and planned the successful assassination of the Grand Duke Sergei. That year, 1905, in St. Petersburg, there were killings, bank robberies, strikes, and riots. The revolution seemed only days away. Then came the repression, more fierce, more efficient, and a great deal more bloodthirsty than anything the revolutionists had ever done. The secret police came in the middle of the night to the homes of the Unauthorized, and they were all arrested except Felix, who killed one policeman and maimed another and escaped to Switzerland. For by then nobody could stop him, he was so determined and powerful and angry and ruthless. In all those years, and even in the quiet years in Switzerland that followed, he had never loved anyone. There had been people of whom he had grown mildly fond, a pig keeper in Georgia, an old Jewish bomb maker in Bialystok, Ulrich in Geneva, but they tended to pass into and then out of his life. There had been women, too. Many women sensed his violent nature and shied away from him, but those of them who found him attractive found him extremely so. Occasionally he had yielded to the temptation, and he had always been more or less disappointed. His parents were both dead, and he had not seen his sister for 20 years. Looking back, he could see his life since Lydia as a slow slide into anesthesia. He had survived by becoming less and less sensitive through the experiences of imprisonment, torture, the chain gang, and the long, brutal escape from Siberia. He no longer cared even for himself. This, he had decided, was the meaning of his lack of fear. One could only be afraid on account of something for which one cared. He liked it this way. His love was not for people, it was for the people. His compassion was for starving peasants in general, and sick children, and frightened soldiers, and crippled miners in general. He hated nobody in particular, just all princes, all landlords, all capitalists, and all generals. In giving his personality over to a higher cause, he knew he was like a priest, and indeed like one priest in particular, his father. He no longer felt diminished by this comparison. He respected his father's high-mindedness and despised the cause it served. He, Felix, had chosen the right cause. His life would not be wasted. This was the Felix that had formed over the years, as his mature personality emerged from the fluidity of youth. What had been so devastating about Lydia's scream, he thought, was that it had reminded him that there might have been a different Felix, a warm and loving man, a sexual man, a man capable of jealousy, greed, vanity, and fear. "Would I rather be that man?" he asked himself. That man would long to stare into her wide grey eyes and stroke her fine blonde hair, to see her collapse into helpless giggles as she tried to learn how to whistle, to argue with her about Tolstoy, to eat black bread and smoked herrings with her, and to watch her screw up her pretty face at her first taste of vodka. That man would be playful. He would also be concerned. He would wonder whether Lydia was happy. He would hesitate to pull the trigger for fear she might be hit by a ricochet. He might be reluctant to kill her nephew in case she were fond of the boy. That man would make a poor revolutionist. No, he thought as he went to sleep that night, I would not want to be that man. He is not even dangerous. In the night he dreamed that he shot Lydia, but when he woke up he could not remember whether it had made him sad. On the third day he went out. Bridget gave him a shirt and a coat which had belonged to her husband. They fitted badly, for he had been shorter and wider than Felix. Felix's own trousers and boots were still wearable, and Bridget had washed the blood off. He mended the bicycle which had been damaged when he dropped it down the steps. He straightened a buckled wheel, patched a punctured tire, and taped the split leather of the saddle. He climbed on and rode a short distance, but he realized immediately that he was not yet strong enough to go far on it. He walked instead. It was a glorious sunny day. At a second-hand clothes stall in Mornington Crescent, he gave a halfpenny and Bridget's husband's coat for a lighter coat that fitted him. He felt peculiarly happy, walking through the streets of London in the summer weather. I've nothing to be happy about, he thought. My clever, well-organized, daring assassination plan fell to pieces because a woman cried out and a middle-aged man drew a sword. What a fiasco! It was Bridget who had cheered him up, he decided. She had seen that he was in trouble, and she had given help without thinking twice.
It reminded him of the great-heartedness of the people in whose cause he fired guns and threw bombs and got himself sliced up with a sword. It gave him strength. He made his way to St. James's Park and took up his familiar station opposite the Walden House. He looked across at the pristine white stonework and the high, elegant windows. "You can knock me down," he thought, "but you can't knock me out. If you knew I was back here again, you'd tremble in your patent leather shoes." He settled down to watch. The trouble with a fiasco was that it put the intended victim on his guard. It would now be very difficult indeed to kill Orloff, because he would be taking precautions. But Felix would find out what those precautions were, and he would have